today was going to be two full chapters, but I thought I'd cut a little bit out. Two chapters. Right. So, as we were, as Sally was saying earlier, this is we're coming up to our two-year anniversary soon. So 2 years since the church has been opened. So assuming that you've all been paying full attention and keeping complete count, because you've got nothing better to do in your lives, you'll know that this is the 12th time that I've preached here. 12th time at Brixley Farm, so that's every other month. It's the 13th time in total, with one being at Christmas Eve at St. John's last year. And in no particular order, so far I've talked about money, I've talked about sin in the new creation, the incarnation of Jesus, Jesus' authority on earth, Jesus washing feet, various sections of Ephesians, Ephesians 1, 2, 3, and 4. But this is the first time that I've preached on anything in the Old Testament. This is the first time that I've actually preached on anything before Jesus was born as a man. And to be honest, when I first started looking at Jesus, what he says, you see, you know when you're looking at the word of Jesus, what he says, it seems in a way quite relatable to us, I think. You know, the parables that he uses, the way that Jesus behaves, the way he treats the people around him, and when you read about him, it's pretty clear what it is he's telling us to do and what he's telling us to how to behave. And it's pretty clear as what Jesus did, what Jesus is doing, and it's pretty clear from what Jesus says what he's going to be doing for us in the future. And if you think the letters of the New Testament as well, that's pretty much the same sort of thing. The letters of the New Testament are teaching about Jesus, and they're teaching about church and how church should be. And again, it's not too difficult, it's not too hard to be able to relate to them. You see, so many of the things that the original, that the first apostles did, and what the early churches did, and what the apostles wrote to the early churches telling them to do, we still do a lot of that stuff today. You know, we pray together, we share bread and wine together, we confess our sins together, we enjoy fellowship, we worship together, and it just seems it's quite, for me, maybe anyway, just it's easier to grasp, it's easier to get my head around what the Bible is instructing us to do in the New Testament as opposed to the Old. So as I sat at my desk this week, I ended up spending quite a bit of time as to why do I find it more difficult? Why do I find it harder sometimes to get to grips with what the Old Testament's telling me? And I'm not sure if I should be saying that or not, but I figured, well, if I think that, maybe other people think it as well. So staring at my Bible, I've read chapters 46, 47, 48 over and over and again, and I found my mind wandering away from the Bible verses to why it's harder to understand what's going on in the Old Testament sometimes. And after a couple of minutes, let's say that, after a little while, I came up with two theories as to why it's easier. First one, and you have to stay with me on these, I'm afraid. The first one is crosswords. Okay, this thought came to me that, you know, a normal everyday sort of crossword. You know, you get asked a question, you either know the answer, or you don't know the answer, or you've got a pretty good idea of what the answer is, but you're not quite sure what it is. So you work around it, and you see that you can work it out, and you can see what the question is asking you. Now, I'm not bad at those sort of crosswords, but you know what I'm rubbish at, and I'm terrible at them, is the cryptic crosswords. I can genuinely, on my life, I can stare at a cryptic crossword question for a day and have absolutely no idea what this thing is asking me. My mind isn't wired that way. I've got no idea how these cryptic questions work. And when I get bored of it, I end up cheating. You go to the back of your puzzle, you find page 16, you go to quiz 4, whatever it is, and then you see the answer. Then you go back to the question, and it's one of those moments of, oh, it's so simple, why didn't I see that? Does anybody resonate with that? That'll do. A couple of them, I'll take that. Now, I think the New Testament, as I say, it's clear most of the time anyway what Jesus is saying. You know, when he preached, it wasn't just for the intellectuals, but it was for everyone. So Jesus says things in a way that most people can understand, or at least can spend time thinking about and can understand after that. But I tend to find the Old Testament a bit more like that cryptic question, and just a bit harder to grasp in places. The second idea that I came up with, and again, you have to bear with me, maybe explains it in a better way that I'm trying to say. In my life, I have absolutely no time, interest, inclination, or desire to watch or read murder mysteries. Not for me. You know, all these, whether it be a TV, a drama, or a movie, or a book, whatever, there's hundreds of Midsummer's Murders, Murder, She Wrote, Miss Marple, Poirot, Inspector Morse, all of them. I have no interest in it whatsoever. My mind just isn't wired that way. Em loves them. Her parents, whenever they get together, oh, did you see Luther do this? I'm like, ugh, nothing to do with me. But that's, I think maybe it's that sort of story, that as you're watching it or you're reading it, and as you're going through it, it drops little pointers here and there, little clues, a bit here and a bit there. And then you get to the end of it, and the detective or whoever it is puts it all together for you. Again, you end up smacking your head, wondering how on earth you missed it as you were watching it. How on earth you missed all these clues and all these pointers. And I think in a way the Old Testament is a bit like that. Again, for me anyway. It's like, I don't know about you guys, but the first time I read Genesis, I must have tried to read Genesis 10 times. Before I became a Christian, I must have tried to read Genesis 10 times. Open it up, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning, here we go. And then I remember being about 23, 24, something like that. I thought, right, this time, Genesis, I'm going to make myself read Genesis. From the very beginning to the end of Genesis, I'm going to go through it all. So it took me a couple of days, got to the end of it, finished it, thought, yep, I've got absolutely no idea what's going on. But you see, after you've learnt about Jesus, after you know who Jesus is, and after you've spent a little bit of time in the New Testament, it all just starts to make a bit more sense. It's like if you read the last chapter of an Agatha Christie book, right? If you go straight to the end and read what happens at the end, then go back to the beginning and then work your way through it, you'll see all the little pointers, all the little clips, and everything that it's supposed to be pointing to what the actual main character is doing and what he's going through. And it's like that answer to the cryptic question. Then you get the answer, and it all just makes sense. And for me, I think that's the way that we should be looking at the Old Testament. You know, if we read it knowing that the answer is Jesus, if we read it in the mindset of everything that I'm reading here is about Jesus, it all just makes a little bit more sense. You know, as Mark was saying last week, the Bible isn't written showing us as the main characters. It's not about what we've done. It's not about who we are. It's not about what we're doing. It's all about Jesus. Now, whether it's him directly by name, or whether it's pointing to him, or whether it's talking about him, it's all Jesus. And we have to keep that at the front of our mind when we look at the words, when we consider the words we were looking at today. And to summarize very quickly what Nick talked through. So Jacob and his sons, this is Joseph's father and his brothers, and all their families, they come to Egypt. Joseph brings his family before the Pharaoh, who gives them some land in Egypt so that they can look after their livestock. Then there's the famine, and Joseph, who is Pharaoh's favorite in the whole of Egypt, is responsible for sort of the day-to-day. He's like the prime minister, as it were, of Egypt. So he's responsible for the day-to-day stuff. And he deals with the people who are starving. He deals with the people who are without food. Okay. I have to sort of going off piste a little bit just to let you know. When I've been doing some research on these, there are so many commentaries about these two passages. And normally, when a preacher stands up here, they'll read half a dozen commentaries, and 80% of them are the same, with a little bit here and there a difference. I must have read 10, and they're all so different, so I've gone with what I think it means. So to start off with, Joseph goes to his brothers, and he goes to his father's household, and he tells them what he's going to do. Joseph says to his brothers, he's going to go up and speak to Pharaoh on their behalf. He's going to explain who they are and what they have done and where they've come from. And then after that's done, then and only then, they will then come face to face with Pharaoh himself. And this in itself, that whole, just that bit, is a demonstration of Joseph's authority and stature with the Pharaoh. Joseph then tells them that when they get into Pharaoh's presence, they will be given land and they will be welcomed into Egypt. So the first thing to think of on that, okay, the first thing to think about is this. Would those brothers have been able to get in front of Pharaoh without Joseph being involved, without going through Joseph? Would Pharaoh, the ruler of the whole of Egypt, have allowed these people into his presence without going through Joseph? Joseph's brothers were mere shepherds. We saw that in verse 34. Shepherds are detestable to the Egyptians. So think about it. Pharaoh ruled Egypt. He's in and out of meetings all day with politicians, important people here, there, and everywhere. He ruled the entire population. He had millions of people under him. Do we really think that these shepherds, these 70 people that had come across, as in verse 70, these 70 strangers to Egypt would be allowed into his presence uninvited? Would they just rock up and knock on his door and they'd say, yeah, come on in? There's absolutely no chance whatsoever that these brothers would have been able to see Pharaoh without Joseph being involved. The only way they'll get to Pharaoh and therefore be allowed into Egypt is to go through Joseph. Joseph, we know, is Pharaoh's favorite. He's the only one with the authority to bring people to Pharaoh. That authority to bring people to Pharaoh was given to him by the Pharaoh. So in one line, Joseph is the only way the brothers will get to be in the presence of Pharaoh in Egypt. Joseph is the only way the brothers will get to be in the presence of Pharaoh in Egypt. So think about it. We know from last week, Joseph represents Jesus in this. Yeah, we know that the brothers, they represent us. And in this particular passage, I think that Pharaoh is representing God and Egypt is representing heaven. Joseph, Jesus, is the only way the brothers, we, will get to be in the presence of Pharaoh, God, in Egypt, heaven. Doesn't that sound a bit familiar somewhere? John 14:6. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the light. No one comes to the Father except through me. The authority that Joseph has been given to him from Pharaoh. The authority that Joseph has to go to bring people to Pharaoh has come from Pharaoh. Again, does that sound familiar? Matthew 28:18. Jesus himself says, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. It's been given to him. So it's been given to him by someone. It's a direct representation, I think, of what Jesus is saying. So with Joseph here in this passage, it's an actual working example of what Jesus has promised he will do. Okay, so Joseph tells his brothers, Joseph says to his brothers, the Pharaoh is going to ask you what it is that you do. He's going to want to know what your trade is, what your occupation, what is it that you're good at. Verse 33, Joseph says, when Pharaoh calls you in and asks you what is your occupation, Joseph tells them to answer that they tend livestock. They are shepherds, just like their fathers before them. Then Joseph says, you will be allowed into Egypt and you will be given land to work. He makes a promise right there that this is what's going to happen. And that's exactly what ends up happening again. But more so, it's not that they're just allowed into Egypt and they're given a little bit of land. Pharaoh says, if any of them have any special abilities, if any of them are really good at what it is that they do, they'll be put in charge of Pharaoh's own livestock. Again, it's a working example in the past of what Jesus has said will happen to us and for us in the future. The Bible says in heaven we will not only worship, but we will also work. Worship and work are not mutually exclusive. A perfect illustration of this is the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve, before the fall, they had a perfect fellowship, a perfect relationship with God. But they didn't just sit around singing hymns and praying all day long. No, Genesis chapter 2, verse 15 says God gave them a job to do, to cultivate the garden. They worked and worshipped at the same time. And that's the same thing will be true for us in heaven. We will do more than sing hymns and pray all day. God has responsibilities for us. Matthew 25, Jesus tells the parable of the talents, which teaches us that based on our faithfulness in this life, we will receive responsibilities in the next life. God will give us responsibilities to carry out in eternity, and we will find fulfillment in doing that. Remember that. We will find fulfillment in doing that. And that's exactly what Pharaoh does here. He gives the brother responsibilities, work to do, and it's an example of what Jesus has told us will happen in the future. So then the next part, Joseph and the famine, chapter 47, 13 to 26. So this famine is in full force in Egypt. There's no food. There's no chance. There's no water. Life really is edging away. There is no hope. It's desolate. But because Joseph had planned ahead, and the Pharaoh had plenty of grain to make bread, to make food, to plant seeds, and so on. So over time, the people of Egypt spent all their money buying this grain from Pharaoh. After a year or so, the money had run out, so the people came back to Joseph and said, "All our money's gone." Joseph then allows the people to exchange their livestock for the food. Then that food that they receive for their livestock sees them again through the next year. When that year was over, they say that there's no hiding from the Lord, there's no hiding from the Pharaoh, that the fact that the money's gone, it's all been spent, the livestock are all exchanged for food or given for food. There is nothing left. They have nothing left to give except their bodies and their land. The people then say, "Why should we perish before your eyes, we and our land as well? Buy us and our land. We will then work for Pharaoh. Then give us the seed that we may live and not die." So Joseph ends up buying all the land and all the people in Egypt for Pharaoh. So Joseph then says, "Now that you belong to Pharaoh, here is the seed you will need to survive. Give a fifth of what you do to Pharaoh. The rest of it keep for yourself. Sustain yourselves and your family." So yes, they'd given themselves to Pharaoh. They were owned by Pharaoh, and they're his property, as it were. But they're not being treated like slaves. Yes, they have to work, and they have to give some of their crops to Pharaoh, but the rest they can keep for themselves. And as I said before, there's so many perspectives on that passage. Some people think of it as that it shows that Joseph was a really good businessman. Some people think that it is a different view is that it shows that Joseph had integrity. For me, this passage very simply explains, I think, the journey of becoming a Christian and how we live our lives as followers of Christ. You see, the Egyptians are starting off in a famine. They're hopeless, they're desolate, they're living in a ruined existence. That is life before you know Christ. Then you start to give yourself to him. He calls you to him and you start to give yourself to him. And the longer you're in the relationship, the more that you give. Until there is nothing left that is your own. You have given everything that makes you you. We sang about it a minute ago. Everything I am for your kingdom's cause. You've given everything that makes you you to Christ. Your life is for him. And it's by his grace that then we are sustained. Joseph did something that saved all the people that were willing to give themselves completely to Pharaoh. Joseph did something that saved all the people that were willing to give themselves completely to Pharaoh. If they were willing to give everything that they are, everything that they owned, everything that made them them, if they were willing to give everything to Pharaoh, they would be saved. Again, doesn't that sound a little bit familiar when we've got Jesus at the front of our mind? Joseph, Jesus, did something that saved all the people that were willing to give themselves completely to Pharaoh, completely to God. If they're willing to give everything that they are, everything that they own, everything they have, if they're willing to give everything to Pharaoh, God, they would be saved. And one last thought on that. Going back a chapter to chapter 46, verse 30, where Jacob hears of Joseph being alive. Israel said to Joseph, "Now I am ready to die, since I have seen for myself that you are still alive. One thing that is inevitable for all of us is that we will all die. One thing is that it's inevitable for all of us that one day we all will face our own death. But we can have the same confidence that Jacob has because we know Christ is alive. So to summarize all of this, Joseph says he will go and speak to Pharaoh and speak to Pharaoh on the brothers' behalf. Joseph has told them what they must do. Joseph has told his brothers what they must say. Joseph has told his brothers how they need to behave. Then if they do these things Joseph instructs, Joseph promises that Pharaoh will be kind. He will be fair and he will allow them into Egypt. Pharaoh fulfills what Joseph has said and then they are allowed in and they are allowed to grow. And I think this is a full working example of what Jesus has said. You know, we are the brothers. We are the family in this story. Joseph, we know, represents Jesus. Jesus tells us what we should do. Jesus tells us how we should behave, how we should treat others, how we should live our lives. Jesus says, if we do these things, he will acknowledge us in God's presence. Matthew 10:32, Jesus says, whoever acknowledges me before others, I will also acknowledge before my Father in heaven. It's the same as Joseph saying, do these things and I will talk to Pharaoh for you. So in these few verses, I think the entire life of a Christian is described. From before coming to Christ, we are dead in the family. We're dead to our sins, dead to our transgressions. Christ calls us to him. He tells us what to do. The journey of giving ourselves to Christ, for some people it takes minutes, for some people it takes years. But the journey, as we grow deeper and deeper in our relationship with him, we are saved as we have been bought by Christ through his actions, through his sacrifice on the cross. And then when we come to the end of our lives, we can be confident for what comes next. Because just as Jacob says, we can be ready to face death because we have seen that Christ is still alive. Christ is risen. You see, where we are now, we're halfway through this process. We've been told how to live and we've been told what to do with our lives. Jesus is now waiting to call us home so that when we die, we can be ready. We can have complete confidence in our eternity because we've seen it already happen in the Old Testament. Exactly the same way that Jesus has said that it will happen for us.